Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Needless to say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack went his rumpet tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, "Be you angels?" And we said, "Nay, we are but men." Rock
on. Yes, folks, and here it is another Sunday night, and we are live right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. This is Scotty Roberts. You're listening to the Intrepid Radio Program. We are here in the darkness of the world. Actually, literally, the dark side of the world this time of night. And over there in not Egypt, not Sweden, but in Florence, Italy, is John Ward, somewhere out in the sticks, and he is absolutely unable to join us tonight because he cannot get his internet to pick up in Italy. So, filling in for John Ward tonight was one famous, well-known, inimitable man who you would have otherwise have seen as being our guest for tonight, but he has now been instantly drafted as co-host for tonight, and that is one mouth of the South, Micah Hanks.
Greetings, Scotty.
Ooh, you've got your God voice on.
Oh, sorry about that.
remember, when you go on air live, turn off the God voice.
Yeah, I've got to remember that. Yeah, exactly. Just imagine, though, when I wake myself up in the middle of the night, you know, flatulence is what does this for most Americans. For me,
yes.
I hear myself, Micah. Micah. Those are impure thoughts.
This is what hits you when you hear, think of flatulence in the morning, impure thoughts.
Well, there's a difference between the voice of God and what we might call, colloquially at least here in the Southeast, morning thunder.
Ah, I have experienced morning thunder. I know of what you speak. It's almost like a vision quest.
See, I'm into, you know, researching these mystery booms, but mystery booms, again, are yet again categorically a very different phenomena from morning thunder.
Morning thunder. It's almost like seeking, if you, you know, some do LSD, some do mushrooms, some do peyote, others do morning thunder.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I wrote a book a few years ago that dealt with those subjects, and I always laugh because there's a nickname that you have for that book. Do you recall what it is?
Well, let's see. The book was Magic Mysticism in the Molecule.
But you call it something else.
I called it something else. Like I can't even remember the M&Ms, the 3Ms. I don't remember. What was the nickname I gave it so many years ago?
I don't remember, but I just remember laughing so hard when you flipped that out, you know. Oh, only like good friends can do.
So, absolutely. And so folks, if you don't know Micah Hanks well, Micah Hanks has been a good friend of mine for a good number of years now. I don't even know how many. And it was actually Micah Hanks who, with me, founded the original Paradigm Symposium. And that's coming up this October 1st through the 4th. But it was Micah who came up with the great idea, and we were talking together on the phone, said we should do an event. And I remember saying to Micah, you remember this, Micah? How hard could it be?
Yes, exactly.
And so it's been, we're going into our fourth year now, and Micah is still a huge part of this operation. And Micah always MCs with me the Paradigm Symposium. And we try to, I remember we were talking before the first Paradigm Symposium, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to say to introduce people? How are we going to keep the action lively? And we said, let's just do the way we do when we do radio. And let's just keep talking and have fun with it and keep the energy high. And do you remember, Micah, that first night after all the build-up to the very first Paradigm Symposium, when the first night was over and we were dismissing everybody to go up to their hotel rooms and have a good night, come down and join us in the bar, and we'll do meet and greet and so on. And the mic went off, and I just looked at you and I went, oh, there went my adrenaline. It's gone. He was so pumped for that show and the opening, and it again just dropped off right at the end of that first night.
It's an amazing sensation when you have to rise to an occasion, and after for us, in addition to you managing the event, you were also traveling back and forth. You know, it was pretty much you and I and a very small staff of people who were helping us, and we had an awful lot going on. And so, yeah, you know, in the livelihood of the moment, you know, getting up there, introducing all the different speakers, you know, discussion throughout the day. I actually gave a lecture that first day just as well.
Yes, you did.
We had a special panel presentation, and then yes, the meet and greet afterward, and it was just incredible. Yeah, so there's nothing like that. It's almost like a superhuman kind of exhilaration that occurs. And I maintain, and I always tell people this too, that those first 2 years with Planning Paradigm Symposium were formative for me. Anyone who's never planned an event and been involved in the planning stages of something like that, you know, there's nothing quite like it. Yeah, it can be nerve-wracking. Yeah, it can be scary at times, but it's one of the most rewarding and enjoyable things that a person can do. And thinking back, here we're coming up on, it's almost easy to lose count. This is year number 4, and it's still, to me, the most fun, the most that I look forward to an event annually. And you and I, you know, we go to a lot of events, and we participate in events and things
like that.
We do. There's just nothing like Paradigm Symposium. This is just a very special circumstance. And so I was looking, you know, it's almost, I would almost say, I came back from an event today, in fact, well, over the weekend, and it almost compared to Paradigm Symposium. And you know what that event was?
Which one was that?
That was the Iowa State Fair, and it was so interesting because here I was out there in this field, and I hear this just off in the distance, and I think, okay, what's happening? Are we under attack? Is this good? And then when the helicopter lands,
oh, it was the whoop 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 whoop.
There you go.
Got it.
When the helicopter lands, it has a very familiar word. This is familiar to everybody right now. As it lands, Trump.
Yes.
Hold on. Trump.
Ah, there it is, the God voice. How appropriate.
I wasn't really at the Iowa State Fair, but yeah.
I was going to say, that was a long drive. You called me about a half an hour ago and said, yeah, I'm just about home.
Yeah. Oh, but you know, but that's all I've heard about.
You know, he's all over the news, and you've got to admit, doesn't matter if you are right or left, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat, or anything in between, or anything outside, you've got to admit that this man has absolutely stolen the spotlight.
Well, let me make another allusion to the Paradigm Symposium in comparison,
sure,
maybe with the Iowa State Fair. At Paradigm Symposium, there isn't a dress code, but you and I have always... And I think all the people who are coordinators with us, they began, especially in the subsequent years, to kind of mimic the style of dress that you and I, and interestingly, even though he was just one of the many guests that year, but of course a dear friend from the outset, John Ward,
yes,
regular co-host of this program, you and he and I, the way that we appeared, we didn't necessarily coordinate it. You and I joked about wearing Star Trek uniforms.
Yes, Star Trek uniforms. the old series uniforms.
Yeah, but here you and I show up with waistcoats, you know, and there was a particular affinity for scarves. Of course, John, of course, with his tweed. It really set kind of an interesting, though inadvertent, fashion kind of a
trend in a bit.
Yeah, it was certainly a standard that was set that first year, and it has continued every subsequent year. And so, which is funny because if you think about when you go to these events, you see people wearing tinfoil hats, you know, and they've got their antennas on, and they've got their Ghostbuster t-shirts, and that's just, I mean, let me just say, for each one of those, respectively, tacky, tacky, tacky. Yeah.
And I've got to say, I come out of the paranormal community, which has a lot of their own events, and I grew very tired of seeing event organizers and speakers and so on. Just the whole event, I wanted it to have an elevated feel about it. And so I said, I'm going to wear a suit and tie. And yep. I generally wear blue jeans, you know, and a shirt and a vest and a tie and a suit coat. And that's the look I wanted us to have. I said, I want us to look not stuffy, but professional, a little cutting edge, and have that feel about us, and that's what we ended up doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I, you know, especially even after that first Paradigm Symposium, I think that even set a different precedent for the way that I looked at things, you know, carried myself publicly, period. I mean, which is not, I think, a superficial thing. I think it's really letting, in a way, the real you out. So the point is be comfortable with who you are. Don't think that you have to be something for where you go. It's okay to dress appropriately for the occasion, but be yourself and allow your actual character to show through no matter where you go and what you do. So this is what's interesting about the Iowa State Fair. I'm hearing more, not about the helicopter or about the other politicians in attendance. As I understand, I think Hillary Clinton was there, Carly Fiorini, Fiorini was there.
Carly Fiorina. It took me a while to learn how to say that, too. I was always mispronouncing that one, too. It seems like there's an extra vowel in there, but Fiorina.
Fiorina, yeah. Third time's the charm. So there we go. I've got it now. But and by the way, I'm cheating. I didn't get the coffee like I said I would. I'm having to skip right straight to Mr.
That's exactly what I forgot, too. I forgot to grab my coffee.
Yeah, so forgive me. You know, I'm having to go with the carbonated soda instead, or pop, as you guys would say. But again, yeah. So here at the Iowa State Fair, here's Donald Trump. He shows up, and, you know, Time Magazine, actually, there was a picture and the caption on the photograph of him. He's you know, he's got his cufflinks and everything, and it was his now famous Make America Great Again cap, and it says, "Dressed for a day at the country club, Trump prepares to attend the Iowa State Fair." And I'm just thinking, you know,
nice.
If I went to the Iowa State Fair, I probably wouldn't have worn blue jeans and a flannel shirt either. Oh, we've got to assimilate with all the local yokels. We got to fit right in.
Well, I will say this about Carly Fiorina. She looked good in what she was wearing. Here's a CEO worth millions of dollars. She's running for president of the United States. She has a solid message. And there she was in her tight, low-hip jeans with a kind of a pink plaid shirt on with the cuffs rolled up. And she actually looked really good. She looked like a fairgoer, somebody that you would see even a night on the town. Frankly, casual. And she looked really good dressed down and dressed casual. And she did a great job.
Oh, I'll have to Google some pictures here. Let's see if I can pull this up. Carly Fiorina at the Iowa State. Yeah, because fashion, this is, yeah, okay, I've got photos here. So let's just take a look. Yeah, you know, it's important to be able to look casual, but still look presidential. I guess that's the point. But, you know, in the Time article, I'm loving this because in the Time article, what we keep hearing about is how the emphasis made about the pork chop on the stick.
Yes.
And how Hillary Clinton's standing there and she's enjoying the pork chop on the stick, pretending to enjoy the pork chop.
Pretending to enjoy that.
She probably hates it, you know. You know, there's nothing appealing about this really to her, but she's acting like so that she can assimilate and fit in. They said Trump took like a bite and looked at it like he was looking at like, you know, like a dog turd or something. And throws it down, you know. Which again, a lot of people don't like that about Trump. And,
well, fair is not necessarily known for its gastronomical excellence. It's right. Usually something on a stick that's been deep fried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or as my good friend, the former prison warden, Sam Parker, used to say, $5 worth of stomach aches.
Oh, there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but, you know, they're brave, at least in that, at least circumstantially brave, we'll say, that they would indulge themselves in the fair food, in the fair fare, because you know how it is. Scotty, being a world traveler, you go to these different locations. You've got to be very careful what you consume, or it could be some local deity that haunts you and your bowels for days afterward.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there were times in Egypt where I never really quite felt out of sorts, but let's put it this way, my body acted differently for many weeks thereafter. And things were not the same. I remember we had some people with us, and we were out on the edges of the ancient lake of Malkata. John Ward and I and about six other people. And John was showing them where the old city would have been. Behind us was going straight west into the Sahara Desert from the edges of Luxor. And in front of us was the mile and a half by about a mile wide lake of Malkata that was built by Amenhotep III in the 18th dynasty. And we're walking along these mounds, and now it's just fertile pasture land in the middle of what used to be this lake. But you can walk along the mounds along the western edge. And John said, this is where many of the wealthy people lived. And we're standing there and we're talking, and all of a sudden, it hit me. And I had to go scurrying for a sand dune. And it was like, the food there is excellent. It's usually like chicken and tomatoes and lettuce and flatbread and things like that. And we drink bottled water or coffee all the time. But, of course, it did something to my digestive system. And I had to run for a sand dune. And then I realized when I'm there at the sand dune, I've got on my typical garb. I've got on, you know, khaki pants and a vest and a shirt and a scarf and my hat and my nice sport coat. And of course, I'm sitting there crouched in a sand dune with no utensils, no toiletries. And so it was, there went my itinerary for my flights out the following week.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
So 1,000 years from now, somebody will say, it looks like we found a traveler, and this was his paperwork, and we could see by this he was eating lots of tomatoes and flatbread.
Yes, indeed. Here we have, next to the paper, what remains of the paper, we have the fossilized coprolite. No doubt of an American man who had crouched here.
You know, there's something very spectacular thinking that someday that little loaf that I left in the side of a sand dune could be, 1,000 years from now, somebody's paperweight on their desk.
Well, let's just hope that it isn't destroyed by extremists. I mean, this is a recurring narrative on this program. And when I'm not a guest, I try to tune in and listen. And I know that you guys talk about it all the time. I guess this isn't even the most recent development, but it's the one that's been on everybody's mind. Khaled al-Assad, the 81-year-old antiquities scholar, okay, who was beheaded recently, but now, you know,
the latest...
Yeah, and the latest story right now is that this ancient temple in Syria, I believe that this was the temple of, is it the temple of Bel?
Yes, I believe
or,
so.
It was a temple too. It was a temple that was devoted to this particular Semitic god. That may not be the name, but anywho, I mean, you know, this is another location that is believed to have been destroyed now by ISIS.
Yes, and this is something, now I've heard a couple of different fronts on this too. I've heard that ISIS is destroying these antiquities, and the world is outraged, and you get very high-placed people like this Minister of Antiquities, and so on, of this particular museum, and of Syria, and of course of Egypt, and of course of Iraq. And they are telling you that these things are being destroyed, yet you see another, I've heard other viewpoints, it's not even viewpoints, other reports on this that have said some of these things are not being destroyed, and that they're destroying copies of some things, they're destroying replicas in order to draw the world into that conflict, and to grab people at every emotional level, from the murdering of people. And they're talking about how some of the films that ISIS puts out of some of their executions, how they are so well produced. They're produced almost like frankly, American movies. So they have some very good people working on their videos. So there has been some question as to whether there has been as much of that as has been reported. But then again, you have people in very highly placed, people in very good positions out there that are telling you this is what's going on. And for a man to have lost his head, the reason that they killed this man was they wanted him to lead them to where they have the relics stashed, the antiquities. And he refused to do this, and he was executed for it. This shows you how much importance that man placed on preserving that heritage and preserving those antiquities, is that he, in essence, he gave his life for it.
Yeah. Absolutely, which was a tragic story in itself. And you know, coming back to the idea that there are these these production values that are visible in these videos, it was no more apparent to me at any time than it was in the series of videos that ISIS released that featured the British hostage John Cantley.
Yes.
And I remember watching that first video, and something that, I mean, it stuck out like a sore thumb. First of all, there was a very modest setting. It was essentially just what looked like a black backdrop, and he was sitting in front of it. But they showed at least three different angles throughout the video. But what's interesting is that there was a prominent mole on one cheek that appeared in both the camera angles. And what's interesting is what they had done is, in editing the video, It was obvious they only had two cameras, one to the side, one in front. And they had reversed the image in certain portions of the edit so as to make it appear that there were three cameras in order to actually improve the production quality.
Yes.
Beyond what they even had available to them. Furthermore, in the background, I noticed you could also hear, like cars honking and all kinds of things. Not that they had necessarily tried to give the impression that they were in some sort of a remote location, but it was obvious that it was anything but, that it was obviously an urban setting and that they had a very modest setup and that they were trying to give the impression that this was something far, broader. And here's John Cantley again, I think it's safe to say there was a certain irony in those videos because, of course, he was talking about, he was willfully doing all this and he did not indicate that he had been radicalized himself or anything along those lines. But that he, said that we were going to be educated about these kind of things. If we look back to those things, by the way, being, of course, the ideology and the reasons for the attacks that were at the time being carried out by ISIS, we went back to like the winter of the previous year, and it was already being reported that it would be likely that John Cantley would be executed. So he had said, so had been indicated in messages that he'd released, and as late as February this year. He was still appearing in videos. Now, I don't know. Do you know what his ultimate fate had been? I don't recall ever hearing.
I don't recall hearing the final outcome of that. And so I'm not sure if he is still alive or if he has been executed now. I don't know for certain. And that's something that's one of those things I'd like to look back into and see what has become of Cantley.
Yeah, so. I'm just, just for quick reference, I've pulled up his Wikipedia page here because he was abducted, he was rescued, abducted again. And then we talk about his participation in ISIL propaganda, but there doesn't appear to be any kind of indication as to his ultimate fate. The final line under the propaganda section reads, since Cantley is a prisoner of ISIL and therefore is necessarily speaking under duress, it's unclear whether and to what degree he actually holds these views, which is kind of mirroring what I was talking about. It's almost ironic, the information that he presented. His sister Jessica had claimed that John Cantley believes two-thirds of what he says in the videos. And again, it's obvious with the editing and everything going on in those pieces of footage that there's some...
I also remember seeing a video of an execution. It was one sole gunman... ISIS gunman with a shotgun, and he had a prisoner on his knees, Middle Eastern prisoner, and he shot him in the head, and of course it blew up his head and the body slumps over. But the way they filmed this, they did slow pans along the ground, with the camera rolling along the ground, seeing the close-up of the brain parts and the skull parts, and finally the blood trickling out of the open, gaping wound in the head. And they did some slow-mo shots of the executioner, pumping the shotgun, and it was done very theatrically, which... I don't know what the purpose of that is other than to either one. This obviously wasn't staged, although you can stage something like that. I'm not saying, and I'm not even intimating that I believe that they actually staged some of these things, just that there have been some reports on it. They're making these things grossly theatrical in order to do what? To draw people in to that conflict, to... give it a theatrical sort, the sort of reality that comes with theatrical releases when you watch a movie. And this is the thing that taps into people's minds rather than videotape. They're doing this on high resolution film.
Yeah.
Probably digital film and production. And so they're using these things. That's not necessarily a recruiting campaign, but that is certainly something that is going to enrage the world. And it's going to tap into the world visually into what they're used to seeing in the movies. And so it clicks in. It's like the opposite of what Spielberg did with Schindler's List. When he filmed that movie, he filmed it all in black and white. A modern movie done in black and white, because that was what was going to evoke the images that we saw from World War II. And so, in a sense, ISIS has done the same thing. They're putting production value into their atrocities.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And again, you know, it gets to a point where, see, you know me, Scotty, I'm not somebody who, I don't look at everything that happens in the world, everything that we see in the media, every tragedy that's reported by the media and say, false flag. We have mutual friends who really do gravitate toward that, what I believe is a somewhat extreme worldview that everything is an inside job or a false flag when there's virtually no evidence to support that. But with the ISIL footage, it's very clear that there is indeed, like you said, a production value behind what they're doing that indicates that there is perhaps less than what is actually being depicted, and certainly what is being depicted is being presented in such a way so as to emphasize and of course, not only emphasize, but I think even expand on the gravity that they're trying to present to the world, which, again, that is propaganda. In one
it
of
is.
Forms, Jacques Ellul, you know, the philosopher, wrote a book that I've mentioned so many times recently because it's so relevant to what's happening in world events. And the book, of course, being titled very simply Propaganda. Well, the subtitle, I believe, was the Attitudes That Form Men's Minds, if memory serves. But, you know, in the book, it's fascinating. And one of the interesting points that he makes in that book, however, is that he said that intellectuals are among those who are most susceptible to propaganda. And he said this because he said that the intellectual mind is the individual who is one who is primarily given to causes and given to a sense of urgency and that they must become involved in world affairs and that they must stand for and fight for some cause. And hence the susceptibility that they have, that they possess naturally for state propaganda is almost unprecedented, which...
See, now that's interesting. I have never heard that take on that before. I would have said it is the less intellectual thinker that would be drawn into propaganda, because the less intellectual thinker is somebody who does not look at the world and look at world issues and weigh them out. The less intellectual thinker is somebody who does not do that. And they are somebody that I would think could be tapped much more easily than the intellectual thinker, who I would tend to believe would be the one who would say, I cannot accept this on an intellectual level because of this, 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 and this. And they could have their points and their conclusion on it. So that's an interesting take on that. I have not heard that before.
Yeah, I know we're coming up on a break. So
we are.
Yeah, but maybe when we come back, we could delve into that a little more, because, I mean, the way that the propaganda narrative is presented, both in relation to those who might represent what we would call the great unwashed in the classical sense, and then also the intellectual elite, it varies in its form, but the emphasis and the effect are present nonetheless, and I think that they're quite apparent. We'll talk about that a little later.
That sounds good, folks. We are talking to Micah Hanks, who is, we're actually not just talking to him. He's not our guest. He's co-hosting tonight, filling in for the absent John Ward, who is in Florence, Italy, for a grand symposium of some sort in the archaeological world. So he will be back with us next Sunday. And so Micah Hanks is filling in tonight and doing a fantastic job. If you do not hear him on the Micah Hanks program or the Graylian Report, you get a chance to hear him here tonight. And go check those out. We'll talk more about that when we come back. You're listening to the Intrepid Radio program right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. We're going to be back right after this. Sit tight.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be Bridging the Gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Egypt, the cradle of civilization, land of the ancient pharaohs, where the living and the dead dwell side by side, and home to Gebel El Silsila. Beautifully situated in Upper Egypt amongst the bulrushes of the iconic River Nile and the ever-advancing sands of the evocative Western Saharan Desert, lays undisturbed 75 million years of Egypt's vast history until now, that is. When one thinks of Egypt, one automatically visualizes pyramids, sphinxes, the massive sprawling temples and shrines, the beautifully preserved tombs of kings and queens, and not forgetting the glorious treasure of the boy king Pharaoh Tutankhamun. Yet very few have ever heard of Gebel El Silsila, a vast complex of sandstone quarries, ancient monuments, tombs, stelae, and now even temples, rock art, and workmen villages, not forgetting Roman roads, bridges, and forts, all associated with the quarrying of sandstone for the past 3,500 100 or more years. Now, Friends of Silsila brings all this and more to you directly from this ancient, wondrous site, with yet more secrets to be discovered by the team. But we need your help. There is so much work to accomplish that there's more than our lifetime's worth. Why not be part of that legacy? Immortalize yourself. Become the next Lord Carnarvon. Invest in the future. Be part of the discovery and the adventure. Why not come and participate as a volunteer? The Friends of Silsila requires ongoing funding from a wide range of sources, and there are many ways that you can donate to help ensure the continued archaeological work, guardianship, care, and preservation of this ancient historic site for future generations. We need your help, so come and join us today at www.friendsofsilsila.com, S-I-L-S-I-L-A, friendsofsilsila.com, and be part of the history. And be sure to look up Friends of Silsila on Facebook to join our group page. Friends of Silsila is a registered Swedish charity, and every penny it receives goes directly to the ongoing work at Gebel El Silsila.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best f***ing awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to ScottAllenRoberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
Folks, we are back live. That one kind of snuck up on me. For as much as I was monitoring it, we're now back. And we've got our co-host for tonight, Micah Hanks, sitting right here in his own studio 1,000 miles away. How you doing, Micah?
It's as though I were sitting right there.
It's as though you were. I did want to talk about how I spent the last few minutes running up to get my cup of coffee, which I did not get prior to the opening of the show, because I always have to have my coffee in my... And call this superstition, call it silliness, whatever you want to call it. I have to do it in my Intrepid mug. And so I went up to find my Intrepid mug, and I was taking my time because I knew I had a few minutes, and I was getting the coffee ready, and all of a sudden the Intrepid mug was nowhere to be found. I eventually, of course, did find it. My son, who did the dishwashing today, had put it on the lower shelf of the dishwasher, and I know this is fantastic news. It's scintillating live radio, but that's where I found my mug, and so I came in. I am now prepared with my hot steaming cup of Joe.
And in that moment, though, of weakness where you were thinking, oh, God, my backup, I've got to have something I can put my coffee in. You looked across at the pink Carol Burnett mug. You thought about that one.
Yeah, that one wasn't going to work. I looked at the tall, I'm a witch, so stay out of my way until I've had this first cup, which was not my cup. And that's my wife's cup. And it's, yes, I there were many different options there. Yeah. There was even, frankly, I was about ready to reach for one of the kids' Star Wars cups. And I do have Tusken Raider mugs, but those weren't handy. So thank God I found my Intrepid mug. All is well with the universe now.
Well, I used to love my Chewbacca mug, but I kept getting hair stuck between my teeth when I drank it.
You know, that's a problem. And, you know, when you drain it or do that, I can't even do Chewbacca. That's it. It's like gargling, kind of. I think my 8-month-old can do the Chewbacca roar, but I can't. Alas.
May the with you, always.
There must always be two.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, which is why I'm here, apparently.
That's right.
So, John Ward absent tonight. Here I am, absent in mind only, and glad to be here, at least in a personal sense, with Mr. Scott.
We're so very glad to have you here, Micah Hanks. And folks, if you didn't know it, if you're just tuning in, this is Micah Hanks live with us tonight, filling in for the absent John Ward, who has time-traveled back to Florence, Italy, and currently visiting the Da Vinci Studios. So I hope he has a good interpreter along, but since he is not here tonight, Micah Hanks, who was our scheduled guest, is now our scheduled co-host. And you can find Micah Hanks over at MicahHanks.com, and you spell Micah Hanks just how it sounds. And even though it seems awkward when you're typing the website in to your browser, there are two H's in the middle, Micah Hanks, yes. And .com. And you can see him at the Graylian Report as well. Hey, Micah, give us a little update on what you are up to these days. The last book that you put out, and of course we've already mentioned Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. You did a book on the Reynolds Mansion, which is really kind of outside the bailiwick, so to speak, of what you write about in general in these fields. You've also written the UFO Singularity, and you wrote the last book, I think it was The Ghost Rockets. What are you working on?
Oh, well, there's always a million things. You know, I've covered a lot of stuff. You know, Reynolds Mansion was more of a really the history of not only a house, I should say, but also of the Reynolds family of Western North Carolina. There were some ghost stories in that book, but it wasn't a book on ghosts and hauntings as much as it was a family history survey. Altered States of Consciousness had preceded that, and of course with the UFO Singularity, really that was a technological forecast of the future as it may relate to certain unexplained aerial phenomena. And then finally, The Ghost Rockets was kind of taking a similar approach, but looking back throughout the decades and looking at the way that innovative technologies at different points through history mirror what are being observed in UFO reports, which to me is a telltale sign that a lot of these things are far more terrestrial in nature than many in the quote-unquote UFO community would have us believe or would like to believe themselves. The latest book I've actually written is called The Maverick, The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting. It's a book on podcasting, as the name would entail, and it's a very unconventional approach to how podcasts are produced, and it really kind of looks also, in addition to the technical aspect of things, why it's a great thing to be able to use to promote a business, why you can take it with you anywhere that you go, and also the role that podcasting plays in new media, which is something that's as fascinating and informative right now as anything that's happening out there. And then, of course, we're going to be working together, you and I, on this compilation.
Absolutely.
For the Paradigm Symposium 2015, which is going to be an anthology that will also, we need a program guide for the event, but this is going to be a very special kind of a program guide because we actually have made the decision to put together this anthology that will feature some of the work of the various speakers at the event, and so that's coming together just as well.
And so, some more, and more than that. Yeah. What I like about this format, which is something you actually proposed for this. In the past, we've done a magazine for the event, just like the Intrepid magazine, for an event guide, and it has all your bios and a couple of articles and advertisements and things like that. This year, we're doing this in an actual book format, a 6x9 book, just like you would buy on the store shelf, and it's going to be rife with articles, as Mike had just mentioned, from not only our speakers, but some other people as well.
Yeah, which is a really neat way for people to kind of all in one have a little something that they can take home. Not to say that, of course, there won't be a fine selection of books from all the various authors that will be present there at the event just as well, but this is going to be a really special kind of a thing for this year's event, unlike what's been done in the past.
And then yes.
As you know, I've been rambling to you for the last couple of days in messages about time travel, which is an enduring mystery for me. But another theme that has come up in the past numerous times throughout the duration of the Intrepid Radio program has been what is it that gives an air of credibility to an individual when they decide to become a writer or a researcher into a certain subject? And for many, if you don't have a PhD behind your name, your perspective, no matter how well educated or well worded, is nil.
That's right. And, and many times in fields that you want to say the fringe fields or the alternative fields tend to draw a lot of criticism anyway from naysayers or people who think that they're smarter than you or whatever. That's out there. But there is criticism in every field, and somebody is always going to come up. I'm pretty sure there was a point where at one point Oppenheimer said, oh, that Einstein, he's simply an ass. I mean, it happens. It comes up. And So the criticism is out there, and a lot of that criticism does lie around credentials. Are you credentialed? And before you carry on, I'll just make a very quick point. In my very first book, Tam O'Hare was my first book, but in my first book through New Page Books, which was on the Nephilim, in that book, I state in the introduction, why should anybody listen to anything I have to say? What are my credentials to present this kind of material and have you accept those credentials? And I went into very briefly how I had a high school diploma. I went to almost 3 years of college and dropped out. And then I went into seminary to start a master's program and was going to be tutored in the balance of my bachelor's degree. And I never finished that after 2 years. And so basically, I'm a guy who is out there with almost 5 years of post-high school education working on my master's degree with no degree other than my high school diploma. And I said, should this disqualify me from being able to research and study? Absolutely not. And I said, I would encourage any of you to look at the things I write as just another apple on the apple cart, and you can add the next apple. You don't have to go to college to do it, but you certainly, all you need to do is take the time to research. And let's get back to your question then. What makes somebody credible?
Yeah, and I guess it really is how you present the data. You know, I think of, the historian Shelby Foote, who did not, interestingly, and again, you know, here in the southern United States, of course, he was one who chronicled a lot of history from a southern perspective or from, you know, called a PhD, but he was a researcher who certainly maintained an academic format. And my own interactions with not only the research community, but what I found as being examples of research within the alternative community, and then also, you know, criticisms that have been, warred against at times, it's really changed my perspectives over the last few years about the way that good research is done. Not necessarily, but as a result of, for instance, being asked to give a brief lecture for our friend Jim Harold for his Plus Club on Monday night about time travel, and also my eventual intentions to write more extensively on the subject. You know, I've spent a lot of time studying everything from Hawking radiation and really the entire scope of the research and the theories that have been presented by, from a mathematical standpoint, Sir Stephen Hawking seemed to validate not only aspects of the universe as it relates to Einsteinian relativity, but also which give us a different perspective on things, specifically like wormholes, time travel, black holes, these kind of things. That's kind of a preeminent area of Hawking's work, black holes, the word even being featured in the subtitle of his most famous book, A Brief History of Time. But what I find is that no matter how much you familiarize yourself with the work of great scientists, great minds, and how much you try to present your own work within a context and a criteria that is equally reputable, I suppose, at least in terms of the presentation of the information, a consistent thing that I find is that, you know, people will look at you and say, you know, this is really great. Now you should have a physicist look at what you've written, which, of course, I think that's in essence the concept behind peer review.
Yes.
Speaking of academic issues, you know, again, in Time Magazine this week, there was a great article about, the fudging of documentation in peer review articles. And to the point that there are websites now that are actually documenting marks against scientists who have been found with questionable reviews in peer-reviewed papers and whatnot that seem to actually not only cast them in a negative light, but also that indicate that often there is, frankly, nothing less than academic fraud that occurs in relation to what people are trying to present in terms of peer review. And you see that as well as in the other parts of the research community. You see that just as well even in the most rigorous academic institutions, which is really disheartening and shameful even.
Yes. And, you know, Tom Fusco is over in our chat room, and he just said, for me, he said, it's the power of the message and the credibility of its foundation. Mm-hmm. Now, the only problem I would find with that, dear Thomas, is that in convincing somebody that your foundation is credible can sometimes be the problem that we have to face. And so we have to establish a certain credibility of character, a certain credibility as Thomas said, the foundations, and as Micah, you were talking about the foundational research that we do. This is why we have bibliographies in our books and chapter notes and so on, is so that people know that we're not just making things up out of our head, but we're referring to other either authors on the topics, to scholars on the topics, to academics, and other source material in order to come up with some good material to present. And I agree with you, Micah, that there are authors out there that just seem to write a book in order to regurgitate something and get their name placed on that regurgitated material. And again, the credibility of some authors is that they're not producing original thinking. They're just reproducing in their own words somebody else's thoughts. And to me, that can taint credibility.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, you and I have talked about this before in the past. There are times where not necessarily as a measure to have to try and prove to the world that, for instance, an author like me can say, well, you know, here is undeniable proof that I'm credible. But also for, you know, personal goals and for purpose of fulfilling those goals, you know, I often wonder sometimes if it wouldn't be worthwhile just to go back to school and no matter what the time and, of course, the cost investment, because it's out the roof these days, you know, is it worthwhile to go back and try and obtain that PhD? What would one... And this is what's interesting. I think a lot of people go to school without really knowing exactly what they're after, and they kind of find their way into something.
They limp along, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look at Sir Stephen Hawking, for instance. I mean, he'd already traveled in leaps and bounds in terms of, you know, where he'd gone with his academic career before he was diagnosed with the early stages of ALS at age 21.
Yes.
You know, I mean, but not everyone progresses that quickly. And he was, even by his peers and his professors, was regarded as being someone who many believed was far more clever than they were. And they were well aware of that when they were talking with him. He was a brilliant guy. He was very tenacious. What's interesting is the concept of someone who kind of finds their way through life a bit and then comes back around and says, okay, now with what I've learned, how might that be applied to a formal traditional education? But then again, more and more also on the entrepreneurial side of things, as we're seeing, especially with the reach of the internet, the World Wide Web has changed and reshaped the way that we find and gain access to information. And I wonder now, because this is absolutely affecting the way that, you know, curriculum is taught in schools, whether that be, you know, in a physics laboratory or, you know, in a history classroom or at a lecture hall, no matter what the circumstances, the way that accessibility to information has changed is causing methodologies as it relates to teaching to change just as well. And so it does make me wonder sometimes, you know, as we watch the nature of academia changing, is the accessibility that we now have something that if not smacks in the face, at very least challenges the traditional learning institution, which at one time was the only way that a person could, in a credible sense, obtain reliable knowledge that was accredited and which bore the mark of credibility when they went forth into the world with that knowledge.
And of course, you mentioned entrepreneurship in there. Let's take that into business or into other categories. The access of information has also greatly affected the way business is being done. It greatly affects the way publishing is being done, television is being done, radio. This is an internet radio broadcast that we're on now, and it goes worldwide. We have listeners all around the world to this program. We talk live. There you are over in South Carolina. Here I am in just about a half an hour outside the Twin Cities across the border into Wisconsin. We'll have John Ward when he's on, coming from either Egypt or Sweden. We've broadcast live shows from Egypt, going down the Nile on a boat. We get guests from all over the world as well, and that is something that has changed the way things are done. The world, I remember seeing an old Peanuts cartoon. Remember Charles Schultz and Charlie Brown and Snoopy and Peanuts?
Yeah.
Which you don't hear talked about as much nowadays because he's been gone for about, God, I think about 20 years or more. But that comic strip, I remember seeing when I was a kid, Linus and Charlie Brown sitting, leaning on the stone wall, talking about how the world has become a smaller place because of the airplane. And there was some quip in there that I don't remember the punchline to the strip. But I remember reading that thinking, what do they mean the world has become a smaller place? Because I was just a little kid when I saw it. Now I understand that. Look how small the world has become, virtually speaking, because of virtual knowledge, because of virtual access, virtual information. It's right there at the tips of your fingertips. If you wanted to go out today, Mike, if I said to you, Micah, quick, we need a book about Martian landscape and how it has evolved from the very beginnings of when Copernicus first saw Mars as a star, or the shape of a star, and somebody else saw a blurry version to what we know now. I need that book, and I need it by next Friday. You could probably tell me, that's a tight fit, but I'll do it.
It would be possible.
It's possible.
It absolutely would be possible. And if one knows how to go about finding good information, I mean, yes, I think that the data could be... I think that even without having an extensive background in exoplanetary topography or geology, that one could, you know, at very least become proficient in the general knowledge.
Yes. General knowledge is something you could certainly find out very easily because it's accessible and it's available and it's at your fingertips. This credibility of authors, credibility of anything that you do. Yes, if I were to ask Micah, write that book on Martian topography. You could do it, but would there be original thinking in there? I think you could add your own credible original thinking even at a moment's notice if I needed it from you.
It would be doable, yeah, again. But then again, I also recognize that being asked to do something like that, I don't qualify as being an exoplanetary topographer, for instance. There's always merit to a person who has a truly extensive academic background in a subject. But again, without having to try and make a case against that, I think we can at least acknowledge that the reach of, you know, knowledge and the accessibility to that knowledge, and really the way that the web is becoming this almost kind of an intangible appendage where we are outsourcing data that we can't or don't want, at least, to store in our brains. We don't have to commit things to memory any longer, which, again, you know, when it comes to physics, there was an NPR study I heard, or rather a report the other day, was talking about how with regard to equations and things that were once taught in school, now research techniques that show people how to find and access this information in the most efficient ways are often what are being taught instead, because yet again, we don't have to remember and recall these things. We can access them. And this is why I've stopped calling cell phones. Cell phones are smartphones. They're really portable multifunction devices.
Yeah,
and this is our connection. This is what connects us to the intangible cloud where we outsource all the information we don't store in our brains. So that's the broader question for me, is that the way that accessibility to knowledge is changing us. And it's also looking at the way, or changing the way that we look at technology, education, research, and all these kinds of things as well. It's an exciting, but at times a kind of scary period that we're going through.
You know, I oftentimes quip with this Einstein quote where he said, "I don't bother to remember anything I can look up." And I would, you know, quip and I would say, therefore, I'm not really forgetful. I'm just a genius. That's the way I see it. But I think that that's what this is leading to. However, there's a big question. We've got to go out to break here in just a few seconds, but maybe we can hit on this a little bit when we come back after the top of the hour here. Does access to all of this knowledge so quickly, does that, in a sense, create an entropy in knowledge, in personal knowledge, that people, that we're starting to degrade and devolve in what we know for sure, or what we've studied and retain, as opposed to, I don't have to retain anything because I can go look it up? It's an interesting question.
Oh, it certainly is. Absolutely is.
Well, folks, you're listening to the Intrepid Radio program with me, Scotty Roberts, and my co-host tonight, filling in for the missing Dr. John Ward, is Micah Hanks. And we're going to be back right after these messages and right after the top of this hour for hour two. So sit there, sit tight, stand by. We'll be right back. Hang on.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be Bridging the Gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you, year after year, with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Hello, my name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm a boxer and a Guinness drinker. Now, it's come to my attention that you lads in America only drink Guinness on special occasions. So let me tell you about this special occasion that finds me drinking a pint of Guinness. I was fighting Michael the Hammer Halleck when the referee stopped the fight in the fourth round due to excessive bleeding. As the referee led poor Hammer, covered in blood, to his corner, all I could think about was I was going to win for the first time in 57 professional fights. However, the referee soon made the discovery that it was my blood covering old Hammer. Now, what can I say? I'm a bleeder by nature. Now, you might be thinking, oh, in 57 is not much of a special occasion. And that's my point exactly. You can drink Guinness any day. Sure, it's dark, but it drinks smooth and easy. You may even find it refreshes your spirit. So don't be so precious with your pints. Grab a Guinness, because it's good to drink.
Guinness Stout, imported by Guinness Fast Import Company, Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, and if you think the Irish only bleed Kelly Green, just come to one of my fights.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Egypt, the cradle of civilization, land of the ancient pharaohs, where the living and the dead dwell side by side, and home to Gebel El Silsila. Beautifully situated in Upper Egypt amongst the bulrushes of the iconic River Nile and the ever-advancing sands of the evocative Western Saharan Desert, lays undisturbed 75 million years of Egypt's vast history until now. That is, when one thinks of Egypt, one automatically visualizes pyramids, sphinxes, the massive sprawling temples and shrines, the beautifully preserved tombs of kings and queens, and not forgetting the glorious treasure of the boy king, Pharaoh Tutankhamun. Yet very few have ever heard of Gebel El Silsila, a vast complex of sandstone quarries, ancient monuments, tombs, stelae, and now even temples, rock art, and workmen villages, not forgetting Roman roads, bridges, and forts, all associated with the quarrying of sandstone for the past 3,500 or more years. Now, Friends of Silsila brings all this and more to you directly from this ancient, wondrous site, with yet more secrets to be discovered by the team. But we need your help. There is so much work to accomplish that there's more than our lifetime's worth. Why not be part of that legacy? Immortalize yourself. Become the next Lord Carnarvon. Invest in the future. Be part of the discovery and the adventure. Why not come and participate as a volunteer? The Friends of Silsila requires ongoing funding from a wide range of sources, and there are many ways that you can donate to help ensure the continued archaeological work, guardianship, care, and preservation of this ancient historic site for future generations. We need your help, so come and join us today at www.friendsofsilsila.com, S-I-L-S-I-L-A. friendsofsilsila.com, and be part of the history. And be sure to look up Friends of Silsila on Facebook to join our group page. Friends of Silsila is a registered Swedish charity, and every penny it receives goes directly to the ongoing work at Gebel El Silsila.
You are listening to the Intrepid Paradigm Radio Network in association with EBN, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Hudson, Wisconsin.
Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
Micah, you and I were talking very recently about time travel. What's interesting to me, I listened to some of the music that was playing in the ads and in our intro, and I'm really drawn. I love music. Music transports me. It transports me to a different place, to a different time. In yours and my talk recently about time travel, the obvious questions always come up. Questions such as, where would you go if you could travel back in time? Where would you go if you could travel forward in time? Would it be ethical? Would it be something that we can ever even conceive beyond the realms of science fiction, because it's something that we say physically and by the laws of physics we cannot attain? So I would ask you, Micah, in time travel, if it were possible, first of all, let's start by asking, what transports you? What are the things that take you to a different time and a different place in your mind? And then, what are the ways you think we could achieve actually accomplishing that?
You know, I guess it's different for everybody, Scotty, what takes you back. But if we're talking about nostalgia alone, the kinds of things, I guess, that take me back are often environmental. When I visit a certain location, and that doesn't have to be a specific location. I just mean that there are certain places you go where you feel like you're transported back. Now, one that does come to mind for me that has had a repeatable effect along those lines, actually three come to mind, that are here in beautiful sunny land of the sky, Asheville, North Carolina, where I live. There's the Reynolds Mansion, which I wrote a book about, which is a pre-Civil War. It's an antebellum mansion, a double-pile Federal-style brick mansion, three stories. Beautiful old Southern home, which as you enter and you see the sights and you smell the aromas, Billy, the owner, and the many people who are the staff there at it, because it's a bed and breakfast now, they work very hard to maintain that feeling of what it was like way back when. The original library is still a library. You know, one of the guest rooms was the original master bedroom of Daniel Reynolds, which was on the ground level, because in those days, the women who lived in the home were not allowed to sleep on the ground level. And there were reasons, of course, for that had to do with strategy and protection. Another location that comes to mind, though, second perhaps only to Reynolds Mansion, is the Biltmore House, the famous home of George Vanderbilt, which was also here in Asheville, still open. It's still the largest private home in America, and it's really not fair to call it a home. It's a palace. It's a castle. I mean, it's got its own indoor swimming pool, a bowling alley downstairs, an entire gym. I mean, an entire array of indoor recreational activities in the lower levels, in addition to the kitchens, in addition to the numerous bedrooms.
That's what I've been thinking of putting into my house, a bowling alley. You know, you also have to think of the expense of something like that as well. As I've seen it in the movies, and I've seen it in places I visited, but I don't know. I'm not much for bowling these days, so it's not my sport of choice.
It is an expensive location, though. It really is, and that's why it's been used in so many films. But that place, if you ever go there, and I hope one day to take you there, Scotty, it takes you back. And Grove Park Inn also is the third location I was going to mention. So I guess for me, in a nostalgic sense, the things that take me back are mostly environmental. Now, we could talk about the neurobiology of what evokes memories, and often scents and smells are associated with that. Music.
Well, I say music, and especially the olfactory nerves, are the biggest progenitors, if you will, of memory. And that's the smell. Just the other day, I don't remember what it was exactly, but I remember saying out loud, that smell takes me back to when I was a kid. And I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was walking into an old school, smell of old books, things like that.
Yeah, that is especially one of those aromas, old schools or libraries. Pipe tobacco smoke for me also.
Ah.
But again, those, I guess, are the aspects that deal more with, I guess, what we might call the neurobiology of...
And in a way, the psychology.
Yeah, of time perception. And when we look at time perception from a philosophical stance, the philosophers of today, the likes of whom, again, of course, are often sadly discredited by guys like Sir Stephen Hawking, and even to an extent others in the physics and physical sciences communities, the philosophers ask whether time is truly an existent dimensional quantity within our observable universe, or if it is merely the byproduct of human observation, which I think, in truth, despite the observational aspect to our study of time and the observable predictions made by the likes of Einstein, which are replicated through and proven and confirmed to an extent through time dilation and things like this. In other words, the way that time passes differently in relation to the speed an object is traveling, as well as the way that gravity from a nearby body is exerted against it. We find that Einstein was absolutely right about what he called time and the way that, and the effects of time in relation to mass and gravity, space itself, all these sorts of things. And yet, I think to an extent, we can still ask whether there is indeed an element to that that has a lot to do with human perception. Because again, this is the question that I always, I guess, in an epistemological, philosophical sense, Scotty, I always come back to. What do we truly know beyond the senses? Now, we can create systems. We can use, mechanized systems, machinery and whatnot, to present tests for, the falsehoods and the fallacies that our senses may afford us. And we can utilize instrumentation to observe the universe and help us verify what we perceive. But nonetheless, all that data is still filtered through the perception of humans.
Right.
And so I do think that there are valid lines of inquiry in a philosophical sense that can be followed that strike the core question, what is time beyond what people perceive? And then finally, when it comes to how might actual time travel be achieved? You know, in the again, strictly speaking, in the nature of the physical universe and the way that this might be envisioned, there are a lot of ways that, according to Einstein's visions of the universe and how it works, that time travel might be feasible. I think J. Richard Gott has proposed the idea of what are not proven to exist, but are believed by some, although there are...
And, you know, I also have heard about when you start studying time on a physical scale, that you are limited by what we know physically. And it's all in theory because we really have not yet traveled at the speed of time, at the speed of light. And, of course, according to Einstein, the speed of light would, if you could exceed the speed of light, you would start to, time travel. It was really just a slowing down. You would stay the same age while things outside, where your point of origin would start to age faster, move. That's not even the language I'm looking for. It doesn't move any faster. If you're exceeding the speed of light, then on a physics level, you will age slower than the things, than your point of origin. That's what I was looking for.
Right, yeah. Einstein said able to exceed the speed of light. This is, and it would be impossible to exceed that. Some physicists look at ways that there might be ways around that, but the general notion here is that, you know, if you're traveling through space and your speed increases to, I think some have posited, you know, something along the lines of, like, you know, 9.99% or 99.99%. Not quite the speed of light, but you're traveling really fast. Then what would happen is that relative to the distance you're traveling and the speed that you're going, you would age normally. But let's say that you travel to a star, you know, 37.5 million light years from Earth. You travel extremely quickly. You get to this star, and let's say that whatever the distance is, for the sake of this example, is a period that can be traversable there and back within the span of human life. Let's say it takes you 20 years, and you travel and you age normally relative to where you are and how you're traveling and the speed and the distance that you're traveling in space. You go to this star, you complete your cosmic mission there, you come back to Earth, only to find that you have aged 20 years and the time that has passed on planet Earth has gone, if not decades, perhaps centuries, beyond the natural age, progression of age that you have sustained. All your loved ones that you knew are deceased. You come back to an Earth that's very different from the one that you left behind.
Right.
And that's the general idea as it relates to, you know, relativity and theory of relativity, about how that would be one modality, I suppose, that we could use for traveling into the future, so to speak, you know, which is very similar, interestingly, to themes in literature that have emerged over the years. Not just Rip Van Winkle, but of course we had other stories. I think that H.G. Wells had actually written an early story that was called
The Time Machine.
Well, that came later. There was an earlier story called The Sleeper Awakes, where a man, much like Rip Van Winkle, he falls asleep and he wakes up 200 years in the future. We can go even further back. There was a story by, I think, the French writer, Louis Sebastien Mercier, or Mercier probably. The story, I believe, was, this is the translated title, I believe it was titled The Year 2440, A Dream If Ever There Was One. And in that story, yet again, there's a man who is transported ahead to the year 2440. And so this is a theme that we see throughout the last several centuries has been present in literature for some time, the idea of a person somehow aging, although Rip Van Winkle, of course, awakens in the future. He's also an old man when he awakens. But he still nonetheless has traveled, you know, a period within his lifetime and has awoken much further in the future. And the period he spent during the quote-unquote travel, which was actually a sleep state, was short as observed by he. You know, it was almost like suspended animation.
Well, so, this ties in very closely to the old Celtic lore of like Tir na Og. I don't even know how to pronounce it properly in the Gaelic, but the land of the Fae. Where if you could go to that land, you would age slower. And there were the stories of those who were taken as a child into the fairy realm. And they lived there for 5 or 10 years, and then they were brought back, and 300 years had passed. And so there's some interesting tie-ins there, and I'm wondering what some of the mysticism of that, of those ancient mythologies, or spiritualities even, how they may have been linked into something that very possibly exists. Because really, when you think about it, now this is, I'm going to hail back to some of my old theological days. This was not taught me in seminary, but I remember 30 years ago positing the theory, do you think that God, when he created time, linear time, created something that existed separate from the rest of the realm where he existed? And so in a sense, linear time existed within a bubble. And if you could break through that bubble, you could exist outside of linear time. And this is the way I tried to explain, like, the verses in the scripture that we talk about. God says he is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and a day is as a thousand years with God. That he could insert himself at any point in time. Now, this is from a particular evangelical Christian brand of theology. But that was what I wondered about, is the time veil pierceable, not necessarily by exceeding on a physical realm or by the laws of physics, but is that something that can be broken through by, in a sense, stepping outside of what we realize as physical time or what we realize as linear time? Is that a way to exceed that? So I've just wondered, sorry, I went off on a rabbit trail talking about, you mentioned Rip Van Winkle, and you talked about some of the old stories. I think that even the old Celtic myths had the same type of information.
Yeah. Oh, but see, I like your line of thought there, Scotty, because especially the idea that time passes differently in the realm of a creator or in the presence of non-human entities. This, without getting into a bunch of discussion about UFOs and things along those lines, again, looking back at mythology and folklore, that is a theme that is present, that temporality seems to kind of be pliable under special conditions. I think in the Mahabharata, the ancient Vedic epic, there was the story of the king Kakadumi, who actually was capable of traveling to heaven to meet Brahma. And I believe in the story, he only spends a very short amount of time there. But when he returns to Earth, he's amazed to find that a much longer period has passed. He thinks he spends only a few days with Brahma, comes to Earth and realizes that, my gosh, the time that has passed has been ages. So that same concept emerges there just as well. And in that instance, in conjunction with an actual journey to heaven, an actual journey to meet the Creator. So the way that time and temporality plays into human culture is just, I think equally interesting to me as the notion of the physical possibility of time travel. And, we're getting kind of close to a break, so
we're right up on top of it. I was only going to mention very quickly that even in, there's a biblical account of where Moses spread the rod of God over the battle that was taking place, and the sun stood still for several hours. And even that, without the biblical scripture calling it a time travel scenario, I think that's what you might have there in that biblical mythological sense, is that there was a day where the day the earth stood still, so to speak. And I'm wondering, I've often wondered if there were any other corollaries in historical accounts from other countries, from other peoples, other tribes that spoke of a day in that period of time where the sun stood still, or if it's just a biblical fable, or the fable, not fable, a biblical story, a mythology.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've got to go out to break, as you just hinted at a minute ago. And so, folks, you're listening to the Intrepid Radio program, sitting here with my good friend, Micah Hanks, who is filling in for the symposium speaking Dr. John Ward. He and Maria Nilsson are in Florence, Italy this week to speak at an archaeological conference. And so he will not be back with us until next Sunday night, should the internet work in Florence for him. They're on the outskirts tonight, so they have no way to connect. And having said that, we're going to go out to break now. You sit tight. When we come back, we're going to try to hit all the topics that we announced that we were going to talk about, but we're going to hit this time travel thing again, because I think it's very intriguing and very interesting. Micah, I think you have some really interesting points to bring up here. So, folks, you sit tight. We're going to go out to break now. We will be back in just a few minutes right here on the Intrepid Radio program on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. You stand by.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The fourth annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields. From ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Egypt, the cradle of civilization, land of the ancient pharaohs, where the living and the dead dwell side by side, and home to Gebel El Silsila. Beautifully situated in Upper Egypt amongst the bulrushes of the iconic River Nile and the ever-advancing sands of the evocative Western Saharan Desert, lays undisturbed 75 million years of Egypt's vast history until now, that is. When one thinks of Egypt, one automatically visualizes pyramids, sphinxes, the massive sprawling temples and shrines, the beautifully preserved tombs of kings and queens, and not forgetting the glorious treasure of the boy king, Pharaoh Tutankhamun. Yet very few have ever heard of Gebel El Silsila, a vast complex of sandstone quarries, ancient monuments, tombs, stelae, and now even temples, rock art, and workmen villages, not forgetting Roman roads, bridges, and fort, all associated with the quarrying of sandstone for the past 3,500 or more years. Now, Friends of Silsila brings all this and more to you directly from this ancient, wondrous site, with yet more secrets to be discovered by the team. But we need your help. There is so much work to accomplish that there's more than our lifetime's worth. Why not be part of that legacy? Immortalize yourself. Become the next Lord Carnarvon. Invest in the future. Be part of the discovery and the adventure. Why not come and participate as a volunteer? The Friends of Silsila requires ongoing funding from a wide range of sources, and there are many ways that you can donate to help ensure the continued archaeological work, guardianship, care, and preservation of this ancient historic site for future generations. We need your help, so come and join us today at www.friendsofsilsila.com, S-I-L-S-I-L-A. friendsofsilsila.com, and be part of the history. And be sure to look up Friends of Silsila on Facebook to join our group page. Friends of Silsila is a registered Swedish charity, and every penny it receives goes directly to the ongoing work at Gebel El Silsila.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best f***ing awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to ScottAllenRoberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
And yes, while I'm sitting over here sticking my finger in the hole of the dike of humanity, there is Micah Hanks over in Asheville, North Carolina, inviting the devil in to play a game of nine-man Morris. Micah, were you inviting him to cards or to just merely rolling dice?
Well, if it were dice rolling, it had to be snake eyes, because all I could see were the two red bulbous glaring orbs hovering outside the window with the implied silhouette of a very large head behind them. So this was, if not the devil himself, perhaps a very large Sasquatch peering inward, hoping to come inside. And I did not invite him.
Well, that's good that you did not invite him in. I did say to Micah frantically over the our messaging here during the break, he said, I'm staving off the Sasquatch invasion, but there are these two red glowing eyes outside my window. I said, don't invite him in for cards.
Well, so, Scotty, you know, before we get back into talking
yes?
about travel, the funny thing is that there's a glimmer of truth behind this silly tale.
Really? Do tell.
Yeah, exactly. I'm best known among my friends as the friend who you invite over to the parties if you don't want to sleep well later that night. What inevitably happens is somebody starts saying, Micah, tell us one of your stories. There are even local...
Tell us a wicked tale, Micah.
It's true. There are watering holes that I'll visit here in Asheville. And at one, I stopped in about 6 months ago, and the bartender was getting off work, and she said, I'm about to finish my shift. But so she brings over a drink, and then she brings over another one. And I said, I can't drink both of those. She said, no, one's for me. And when she got off of her shift, she came around on the other side of the bar, sat down next to me, and she says, now, just tell me where you've been in the last, you know, 2-3 months. You always tell the best stories. And so I didn't realize I was a storyteller, but people like hearing these stories. But I had a really good one told to me today. I guess that's how a good storyteller gets, you know.
That's where you glean your information, yes.
Yeah, people tell you stories. And so I was catching up with a buddy of mine named Aaron, who grew up over in eastern Tennessee. And the long story short here was that we got off on the subject of Bigfoot somehow, and we were talking about this. And I'd mentioned a story about two hunters that encountered something that was walking upright, but when it spotted them numerous years ago, this was near Cherryville in eastern Tennessee, when it spotted them, whatever this thing was, it broke into a run, but it ran on all fours, kind of like a chimpanzee. And my friend said, oh, well, that's not all that strange, I guess, for this part of the country. He said, I knew a fellow many years ago, and he had said that, you know, they'd gone and they just moved into this house that was out on the fairly remote end of this county where they lived. And he said he was perhaps, my friend Aaron said, the most honest guy I knew. He was a very religious fellow, which will come into the story a little later just as well.
Okay.
The story he told was quite simply this, so that he woke up one night and they'd moved into this house fairly recently. They hadn't even hung any kind of drapes over the windows or anything like that. And so there's this great big wide open window that was about 8 feet off the ground. And he said that he woke up in the middle of the night to observe the silhouette of a very large head, which was peering just up over the windowsill, which should give you an idea about the height being somewhat, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 feet off the ground or so. And he said that there was what appeared to be the reflection, the red reflection off of the incredibly large eyes of whatever was peering in the window at him. And his response was utter terror. He thought he was dreaming at first, but he said he lay there for a long time and that this thing stood there peering in the window looking. And he lay there for the longest time until eventually it went away. And finally, he never went back to sleep until nearly dawn. But his interpretation of that had been one of a demonic nature. He was convinced it was some sort of a demoniacal creature, you know, some sort of a being rather than something physical. But he nonetheless described very physically the shadow, this very large head and the red eyes, which is a consistent trait that some people who purportedly have encounters with non-human beings likened to Sasquatch and whatnot.
I've heard that in many other stories, from bog monsters to... I remember somebody sent me some photographs of a riverbed where their children were playing in the back bushes way in the back. You across the river, you could see this pair of red glowing eyes in the dark. In the dark shadows. And they were there in one photo and gone in the next. And you never know, you know, what people are sending. This is about 10 years ago somebody sent that to me. But, that is a common thing to see. And I know, like with large cats and with dogs, raccoons and things like that, when you catch them in your headlights or in a porch light or a flashlight out in the backyard at night, you can usually tell they're yellowish or white, but I personally have never seen a pair of red glowing eyes.
Yeah, me either, although I've heard numerous stories about people who claim that they have seen them. And that's an interesting thing that continuously appears in the literature, you know, that surrounds the Bigfoot monsters and whatnot.
Right.
You know, I try to be, I think a lot of people think I'm just saying this just to try and maintain an air of credibility, but no, I legitimately have tried to train myself over time to truly be skeptical of things like this. And I also am very open-minded to the possibility. It's just that I won't take an anecdotal story like that and say, oh, well, this thing had red eyes, and so did this one that Zeke over here talked about and the one that Elmer talked about. And so, obviously, Bigfoot must exist.
Well, really, that's an amazing story. You know, I hear stories like that, too, and I don't think I've so much trained myself to be skeptical, maybe to a certain degree, but there were certain things that drove me away from things that I held to be very cherished faith issues in my life. And those things became at one point very hard for me to grasp anymore or to accept anymore. And that has spilled over from a religious belief into a belief of, I look at myself, if I sit back, I'm sitting here in my studio, which is in my office, and it's surrounded by all kinds of little artifacts. And you've seen my office and how I have things set up and, you know, from swords to artifacts to junk to Star Trek stuff to books to, you know, it's a collection, a cacophony, a veritable cornucopia of mythological and mixed with archaeological and historical. I love this stuff, and I surround myself with lore, with folklore, with storytelling, and so on. But at the same time, I have found, while I am so attracted to it on one hand, there is another side of me that is becoming more and more skeptical of the other stories that I hear. I can have my own stories, and I certainly have, and you know some of them. I have fanciful stories of things that have happened, some of them very mysterious, some that could make people want to sit with the lights on at night. And these are things that have happened to me, and I know they're true, punctuated by a goddamn it at the end. but when somebody else tells me those kinds of stories, my mind immediately goes to the skeptical. And I say, while I know I have experienced certain things, I cannot always accept as credible somebody else's experience, because everybody's trying to pull a fast one on somebody somewhere.
Yeah. And very briefly, just to kind of encapsulate all that, recently on the Grayling Report podcast, one of the subjects that I had chosen to address, and this was also addressed in a Mysterious Universe article that I wrote, was whether or not it's worthwhile for us to continue to debate over whether what we see in the so-called Patterson-Gimlin film from 1967, the very most famous piece of footage
Yes. Purportedly
showing a Bigfoot.
By the way, before you go forward with that, Connie over in our chat room says, I believe I've seen a Bigfoot, and don't laugh all you want, but there were no red eyes.
Oh. And not every report betrays that characteristic. And again, my aim is not to try and discredit those who say that they've seen.
Right, right.
But when we talk about the Patterson-Gimlin footage, there's a lot of dirt associated with that. And what it has led to is, rather than good data supporting the existence of the creature, and I should point out, by the way, that the various interpretations of the skeptical scenario that led to the hoaxing of that, if that's indeed what has happened, they are numerous and conflicting just as well. One theory is that John Chambers, special effects designer, had actually
Yes.
the one who created the suit. One different interpretation had been that, according to Bob Hieronymus, one of the men who claimed to have worn the suit, retired Pepsi bottler from Yakima, Washington, he had said that Patterson sewed it together from horse hide and that it stunk when he wore it. We had Philip Morris, a costume maker in Charlotte, North Carolina, about 2 hours south of me, who said that he sold the suit to Patterson. And sadly, the different varieties of the skeptical narrative have been sewn together in their own right over the years to try and
Right.
form one narrative, when in fact what we see is, even with the skeptical side of things,
and they all smell of horse.
Well, somebody had to be lying, Scotty.
Exactly.
And that's what's interesting. The skeptics, you know, when they want to disprove something, they can look at all the people who said this was all bogus and here's why. But when the conflicting skeptical accounts emerge, they don't look at that as being dubious in itself, despite the fact that obviously, by virtue of the conflicting accounts, someone must have been lying. Now, that doesn't do any better to prove that the video is real. But what it shows me is that with the debate over the origin and the authenticity of the film, it does not present good data to substantiate the argument for Bigfoot, and hence I say we leave it behind.
Well, and let me ask very quickly, is some of the modern digital dissection was the word I was looking for, digital enhancement and dissection of the Patterson-Gimlin film, does that then start to say, maybe there is some credibility to this creature caught on film? Or is it a case of trying to fit the skeletal movements and the digital enhancements and so on to what they're seeing in the film, as opposed to the film actually carries that? And that, of course, creates even more skepticism in either way. But on one hand, it says, well, maybe there's some credibility to this. But then you got guys, even people you know, who said, I sold them the costume.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up, because there was a recent Reddit thread that actually addressed the fact that a recent stabilization had been presented by a Reddit user, in which they took the creature they centered the creature.
Yes, I've seen this.
Right, and so hence it stabilizes the footage and centers the creature so that you can see the movements and whatnot more carefully. The skeptical website that reported on this, first of all, was unaware of the fact that researcher M.K. Davis has for about five years, has been producing stabilizations that were far better than the one that the Reddit user had put up. And they furthermore said at the skeptical website, which I think is called, it wasn't a very memorable name, but the site said that thanks to this stabilization that's been produced, we can now see clearly for the first time what the creature is, which in fact looks more like a man in a monkey suit than ever before. Whereas the researchers who have been proponents had used previous stabilizations to say that you can see muscle tone.
And now shows exactly how you can see the muscle tone. And actually, I viewed one of those earlier stabilizations, and where they were pointing out where muscular movement could be seen beneath the fur, you actually could. Now, I was not duped. I was not suffering from a little motion pareidolia. I could see that because I was looking for it. I could see the certain things, characteristics, physical characteristics they were pointing out and said, hey, you know what? They may be onto something there which might lend some authenticity to this film.
Yeah, and I'll just say this also, just since we're talking about it.
Sure.
The big problems I have with the film are the fact that, of course, there's been a continued debate over where the actual film was developed, which seemed to indicate that Patterson may have lied about the date that the film was made.
Ah.
That has been a big issue, but the other issues are those that have to do with anatomy and primatology itself. We have a female which has very obviously large breasts, but there appears to be, in the footage, hair on those breasts, which is inconsistent with other great ape species.
Right.
We've got the peaked skull, which is indicative of what we call a sagittal crest, but that is a prominent feature among the male members of certain species. In the human ancestry, the last time we saw that was Paranthropus, and it has never, to my knowledge, ever appeared on a female of the species. And finally, the footprint length and the distance between the footprints that were measured and casts were taken of those at Bluff Creek after the film was made do not match the purported height. There's a ratio that always applies that between the length of the foot and the distance can generally help us calculate the height of the creature. It didn't add up, and John Napier, the primatologist, pointed these things out. Now, in contrast to that, the late anthropologist Grover Krantz had said that the sagittal crest, on the other hand, may actually not be a male or female characteristic, but instead a size characteristic, in which case he argued primatologically that, in fact, if the creature were large enough, the sagittal crest may have been present in order to accommodate the creature's size. What that actually does is it presents more space on the top of the skull for the attachment of muscles that control the powerful jaws, which an herbivorous creature would use to chew the food that it eats. But that presents another problem in itself, because when a great ape species standing upright, especially most prevalent among chimpanzees, orangutans, and gorillas, when they're standing upright, you'll notice they have a pot-bellied appearance, and that's because of their diet.
Yes.
And if the sagittal crest is present, which indicates the powerful jaws, and they're, you know, it may be an omnivorous diet, really, because we don't know exactly what a presumed Sasquatch is going to be eating, but we would presume that probably they have a lot of foliage.
Well, according to Finding Bigfoot, they do eat deer, rabbits, and raccoons.
I interviewed a retired police officer who actually passed along to me a casting of a footprint of the creature that he said that he observed. His name is Ken Storch. And Ken said that when he encountered this thing in Pennsylvania, that it had a small whitetail hung over its shoulder. So there are a lot of anecdotal reports.
Saw a video just last week from somebody who said that, and of course, silhouetted in the woods with bright light coming from the sky behind them on a ridge up above in the woods, they see two Sasquatch walking, and one of them seemed to have a white-tailed deer slung over his shoulder that was kind of flopping a bit with the pace of the Sasquatch, who then dropped it on the ground in front of a tree. And so it's very interesting. You know, by the way, you mentioned having an imprint. I have hanging on my wall here right behind me, and you've seen it, I do believe, a plaster cast that was made off of one of the original plaster casts of the Patterson film.
Yeah.
And so it's hanging here on my wall. And I look at this, and it looks less and less, the more I see real footprints and some of the things that they say, it looks less and less like a real footprint.
Absolutely.
Even though
a podiatrist, Scotty, to look at that particular casting and say this does not look authentic. So
it doesn't.
The anthropological, primatological evidence, everything down to the photo lab that purportedly, which we don't know where it was, all that Patterson would say was that it was a private lab, but everything seems to point to there being some sort of, you know, weirdness going on with that film. And that's both, again, as I'll say in fairness, on the skeptical side of things as well as on the believer side of things. So I just say that may not be the best evidence to be looking at. Let's leave that alone and try and find better data to support, you know, or maybe to refute the idea that a Bigfoot exists. But I personally think, to mirror Jane Goodall's previous surmises, I remain hopeful. I guess I'm a romantic. I haven't seen that you know, magic bullet yet, but I remain hopeful that maybe there's something more to the myriad of anecdotal data that I've poured over for decades. Personally, I'm only 32 years old, but I have spent decades studying this sort of thing, and I've had stories told to me by very credible witnesses, by people who I know personally who've seen.
Well, and this goes back to one of the original cut topics that we entered this program with tonight, is credibility. When you start to, I used to say this when I worked with the Ghost Hunters from the Sci-Fi Network, was I all the time had people saying to me, these two aren't credible, there's this, there's that, there's the other thing. And I'm sorry, they didn't say they weren't credible. They said they were lying or they were making things up and so on. No matter what you want to think about that, my standard response used to be, well, I know these guys, and I know one of them in particularly well. And I would say that his personal credibility as an individual supersedes what your claim is. And for me, while there's a question, I say I would hail to the man's credibility. The same thing I look at with psychics, or I look at with politicians, or I look at with anybody that's got a story like we're talking about with Bigfoot, or any of these topics that we tend to deal with, is when the story sounds incredible and there is skepticism and there is back and forth, and there is, say, just with the Patterson-Gimley film, you've got stories that constantly contradict each other on the same little facet of the research will contradict each other on. And like you said, somebody's got to be lying. When it comes down to that, I start to try to look to the credibility of the people giving me the account or giving me their particular story or their particular take on the story. And I have to look to, is the person in their lifestyle a credible person? What do people know of them? Do they know these people over the decades they've been alive to be credible people? Not that they aren't human beings and make mistakes, but are they credible people? How do people feel about it? And that's what I start to try to look to when I have to gauge this. And of course, I'm ambivalent about the Patterson-Gimley film. You know, I don't care. At this point, there's so much controversy over it that it's not on my platter. But these are the things that I would say, look to the credibility of people and to the credibility of the person telling the story. If you're going to doubt their story, I had one very good friend of mine once say, when I gave an account of having actually seen an apparition, he said to me, he says, yeah, well, he says, you know, it was late, it was 3 a.m, and, you know, you were tired, and you really needed to see a ghost. And I said, now, wait a minute, stop right there. I said, you've known me for 25 years. Have you ever known me to be an individual who will make shit up in order to have a good story? I said, have you ever known me to be somebody who lacks credibility in that respect? I said, I don't need to see a ghost so bad that I'm going to make it up. And I said, I'm there to research. And he said, well, I have to admit, yeah, as long as I've known you, you've never been somebody who would do that. I said, so there you have your conundrum for the day. How could somebody who you deem credible have seen something without hallucinating and being of sound mind and body?
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, Scotty, I guess as we're kind of winding things down, it comes down to me to really being not so much that I'm fascinated with the unexplained. I suppose I still am, but my definition of the unexplained is much broader than what it once was. My interest it once would have been Fortiana, you know, and what we call cryptozoology or what we call UFOs. To me now, most of the day when I'm sitting around studying the unexplained, I'm studying physics mysteries. I'm studying how could we replicate conditions on planet Earth for a black hole or wormhole or singularity conducive to the creation of a time travel machine, for instance. You know, I look at the universe and I find plenty of mystery and wonder without the kinds of things that the alternative community presents. But I am still fascinated by those things in equal measure. But what seems to be the most fascinating of it all, and this may have to be my final point for the night, really, is human nature and the way that the skeptic versus believer attitude, this has always been an interest, a mutual interest of ours. I see the way that both sides approach all this, and I'm dumbfounded because people, whether they are for or against something, are better at convincing themselves of an ideological perspective than they really are. And what my journey has been is unlearning that act of convincing myself of things and truly being unbiased in my skepticism so that I can be a true skeptic, not one who's merely pushing an agenda.
I will tell you, and I'm guilty of having done that in my own past, is you are so invested in an agenda, if you will, that you don't realize it's an agenda sometimes, and you will push that. Sometimes to the point of saying, I'm going to push. I recently rewatched or ran across it accidentally, a debate that I had with P.Z. Myers in a very different setting on ancient aliens. And surrounded by a lot of the people who follow him, a room with about 300 plus people in it. And I was watching this debate, and I found myself not struggling in the debate as so much as to relying on the quick, the witty, the standard lines I had heard. And as I watched that, I thought, I can see myself even thinking, you know, I agree with him more than I disagree with him.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting.
It is interesting. But I find more often these days that I agree more with the skeptics that continue to fight with me than they seem to be willing to find common ground with me.
Yes.
And again, I see that in politics. I see that in religion. I see that in all walks of life. And so for me, the study has become that of human nature and trying to understand what drives people and motivates them to become so unforgiving in their attitudes and so given to belief in a certain idea or notion or ideology.
Absolutely. And you know what, Micah? I hate to say it. We've almost got to leave it on that point. I want to thank you profusely for sitting in tonight for John Ward and for the very interesting topics. We had a few things mapped out we didn't even get to tonight. It is always a pleasure, and it is always interesting, and really, for me, fulfilling to sit and have a good conversation with you. And when it's on air, it's even more fun, because there's more technical junk to have to worry about.
Yeah, people listen in. Yeah, people get to be the fly on the proverbial wall. Thank all you guys for tuning in tonight to Intrepid Radio, and glad to be here, filling in for the irreplaceable Sir John Richard
Ford. Very quickly, in 10 seconds, where can people find you?
www.micahanks.com is my website. All you'll need to know about me can be found there.
Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening tonight. Join us here again next week for the Intrepid Radio program, and also this Thursday at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time for the Situation Room with Rocky Stucci. See ya. Have a good night.
Desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire burning the trees. And I see fire hollow in soul. I see fire blood in the breeze. And I hope that you